STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my friends. Greg Kokel here. Show us Stand to Reason. I've been thinking about, like, different ways to start the show and different ways to introduce myself. But, I mean, there it is. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason. What more can I say? Glad to have you on board. I always say that, too, but it's true. Glad you're listening here. And always thrilled to find out when we have, as we go out and among our dear people visiting different places, speaking, to meet you and to know the impact that that God is having in your life through what we're doing here. That's just great for us. I am spending this hour here chatting with a buddy who's written a book that's worth reading because it deals with something that challenges every single Christian. My guest is in line two. Is that right? Line two. That's Bobby, right? Okay, I'm gonna get the right line. Hey, Bobby Conway,
Pastor. Hey, Greg, how are you, bud?
I'm doing fine. I'm glad to have you back with us on Stand to Reason. And I actually didn't give you your propers here. He's the author of the Fifth Gospel. When we had you on and to talk about that last time around, didn't we?
Yeah, we sure did.
And probably best known for the 1 Minute Apologist. These are videos on YouTube. Why don't you just give us a brief description? It's pretty self-descriptive, but tell us what you do on 1 Minute Apologist, Bobby.
Well, we've got about 800 videos right now. We produce 5 videos a week where I do many of the questions myself,
uh-huh.
or I'll have different apologists and philosophers on the program. And we seek to provide credible answers to the curious questions that are out there. And they're short, they're creative, they're in a black and white context, and they're user-friendly.
Mm.
There's a search engine at oneminuteapologist.com where people can go through and search by the guests we've had on or the topics, and then they can use them in Sunday school, small groups, professors use them, teachers use them, and we seek to hit a whole plethora of topics to help people to feel strengthen in their faith.
Yeah, well, that's great, Bobby. I've seen them. I've been on a few of them, I think, and the rest of our staff has, and just about anybody else is making a contribution in our general field. It's a great contribution yourself with the 1 Minute Apologist. And what I like is that they're short vignettes. You know, I mean, they're probably, most of them are more than 1 minute, right? But they're very brief by and large, right?
That's correct. I mean, by 1 minute, I am just saying, you know what, it's brief. And by 1 minute apologist, I don't want to minimize at all the importance of depth. I am passionate about depth
mm-hmm.
and being well-trained. But I do recognize that there's a niche in our soundbite culture. And so I'm just seeking to kind of get in there. And then a lot of times we're putting up your book or other people's books
mm-hmm.
at the end of each episode to say, here, go here for a deeper dive.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think we're working together in this world of apologetics, and we're each just trying to fill this pie up with different slices. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to do
mm-hmm.
is just expose people and get them excited. And so we use creativity. We try to be practical. We try to share stories. I use interviews. And I think some of that hopefully will just help people to see, you know what, I can relate to,
mm-hmm.
to Bobby or to the guests. And you know what, that was helpful. And then hopefully it really creates a real pantheon then for them to get on radio programs like this or read books or so on and so forth.
Yeah, well, I like your phrase about working together, because this has been from the very beginning, 22 years ago at Stand to Reason, a value we had. We're not going to reinvent the wheel. Let's pull a lot of other people who can do some things better than we can, maybe have explored some areas we haven't explored so well, and they've done the heavy lifting. Let's bring them on board and let them have their say, you know. And so that's why we're glad to work with you. In fact, you and I work together in Charlotte with CIA in August,
mm-hmm.
Frank Turek and Brett and Jay Warner Wallace and the boys. We just had a great time together there. And
absolutely.
Yeah. Your book now, the one we're talking about, is titled mysteriously, kind of, or provocatively, Doubting Toward Faith. And as I recall, that's what you spoke on, isn't it, at CIA this summer, right? You covered the details about this.
You know, when I talked about, when I did this book, I think that this idea of faith, and you would certainly say the same thing, it can have a real negative connotation. And, you know, we don't mean taking an existential leap into the darkness right. And keeping your fingers crossed. We're talking about having confidence. But the word doubt means essentially to be in two minds. Uh-huh. And you can doubt toward unbelief, or what I'm contending is you could doubt toward faith in the evidence that we do have there. But doubt doesn't stay put. It's not neutral. It takes on a direction. Hmm. And a person who's struggling with doubt, it can be a very agonizing state.
Yeah. Yeah, I can think of times, you know, when I have, it's like a cold chill. You see something that you didn't expect to see, maybe an argument or an approach or something, and you think, I don't know how to answer that. That sounds compelling. And then all of a sudden, this icy feeling wells up in the pit of my stomach. Like, maybe, gosh, have I been wrong about everything? How do I deal with that? And I know the feeling, and fortunately, people like you and I, Bobby, not that we don't have doubts, but that we are in a much better position than most to have our doubts addressed with substantive things to help us out. In fact, I even think in the last hour's podcast, I mentioned something about the toughest critic one will ever face is themselves. And I don't know that there is a Christian alive who has never doubted at some time or at some level. And I'm looking at some citations in your book, and you've got John Calvin here and Charles Spurgeon and C.S. Lewis and Karl Barth and Francis Schaeffer and Billy Graham. These are all guys who talk about their own doubt at certain times in their lives that was almost debilitating, and it forced them to rework some of their own understanding of these things.
Yeah, I like to say that, you know, doubt is not a Christian problem. It's a human problem. Uh-huh. And in the absence of certainty, there'll always be room for doubt. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do as apologists is we're asking which worldview best closes the doubt gap. Mm-hmm. And so as Christians, we also work together in our different fields of expertise, and different PhDs come together because we believe that Christianity provides the greatest cumulative case. It doesn't mean that we're not vexed by our questions, mm-hmm. but one of the things that helps me, Greg, is if I'm sharing the gospel with somebody and they were to bring up maybe an objection they had to Christianity, mm-hmm. I think what can be helpful is for us to be able to say, you know what, that's a good point, and I can understand how you would ask that question, and I can feel that too sometimes, mm-hmm. but if we're aware of their Achilles heels, we can say, but you know what, you as well have your own doubts, and mm-hmm. you can't put the pie together perfectly either. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we let them know that we're all finite, the question is which worldview really does deal with our doubts the best.
Right.
And Christianity doesn't erase my doubts. I still have certain questions. I have to trust, you know, there's things like hell, like I see it in the Bible, but boy, I don't like the idea of hell. I just don't feel like I can just erase it away.
I feel the same way about that.
I don't like the idea of lots of things, but I have mm-hmm. to trust God and go on that journey.
Yeah, I have Lewis's citation here from your book here, and C.S. Lewis says, "Now that I'm a Christian, I do have moods in which the whole thing looks very improbable. But when I was an atheist, I had moods in which Christianity looked terribly probable." And this underscores your comment you made a few moments ago that doubt is a human problem. Not just a mm-hmm. Christian problem, and Lewis says it well there. And I was thinking about the problem of evil. I have come to a point, at least with that problem, where, of course, never say never, but it seems to me that from my awareness right now, it is not a difficulty for me because I know that there can't be a problem of evil unless there is a God. And if you get God out of the equation, you can't even make the problem intelligible. And what could be more obvious existentially than the problem of evil? And it's because of what you just said here. What worldview closes the doubt gap? There is no worldview that makes sense of the problem of evil as well as some form of theism. And so I'm not enticed at all by the problem of evil to leave Christianity, because Christianity predicts the problem of evil, you know. Talk about closing the doubt gap.
That's well said, Greg. You know, another thing as it relates to it, it's like I don't like evil in the world, as you don't, but we can see that God is still just in the midst of this. So I go, okay, we listen to an atheist. Obviously, they might bring up, I can't understand this whole, you know, issue with evil. And to your point, you know, if there's no such thing as a moral standard, you know, then there's no such thing really as evil. But Right. Then again, suppose we were to step into atheism, I'd have a harder time living with the lack of no ultimate justice Right. Than I would with the question of recognizing what is there, the mm-hmm. problem of evil, but then the timing of when God is going to mete out his justice.
Right.
So I think under atheism, you have no ultimate justice. In Christianity, you do have ultimate justice. It's just in this world of evil, God doesn't always operate, deal with things at the time we want them to. And the problem is if God does step forth and judge or do certain things, then even in the scriptures, the people complain against him when he does that.
Yeah, right, right.
He doesn't execute,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, certainly. I think the problem of justice is a double down for us, because not only is there no justice executed in an atheistic worldview, which is trouble, but there is no justice in an atheist worldview in the sense that the word can't get any traction. The word justice itself, which requires that there is a right and proper end for those who do what is wrong, entails objective right, justice, and objective wrong, which are categories that don't even exist in a naturalistic worldview. So in a certain sense, they have a double problem with the issue of justice. And you've written the book on doubting, and it's Doubting Towards Faith, The Journey to Confident Christianity. Part of this, as I understand it, is driven by autobiographical elements, your own struggle with doubt. Tell us a little bit about that, Bobby.
Well, you know, I think what can happen, as I never heard the gospel till I was 19, grew up in California,
really?
Big partier, gave my life to Jesus. And I was looking to get two questions answered, Greg.
Mm-hmm.
First, what do I do with my guilt? And secondly, what's the purpose of my life?
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I heard Greg Laurie speaking at Chuck Smith's church there in Southern California
right.
on a Monday night.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept going, and eventually I gave my life to Christ, and I found that in the gospel those questions were answered.
Mm-hmm.
Now, depending upon which church you become a part of, a lot of times we don't know what questions to even ask. In some churches, you'll be a member, they'll give you a short list. The danger is that sometimes people will give you such a long list, and they'll be so rigid on, you know, it's pre-cherub, it's KJV only, it's young earth, or it's old earth, it's NIV, it's post-trib, whatever those issues are, they can make the list so long that the person who's growing in their walk with God, they feel like they're doing something wrong against their maybe denomination or
mm-hmm.
against their church, and really they're just thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wish early on I would have had somebody say, you know what, Bobby, your job's to love God with your entire being and to love others, and then be discipled in letting me know some of the different views and letting me know it's going to be messy at times when you're studying. And don't think just because you've read one book or two books that you've got your God in the box
mm-hmm.
on that particular line of theology.
Mm-hmm.
And that as you go through your journey, you're going to think and you're going to grow, and one book's going to inform your views on another book that you read. And what happened to me, Greg, is I just got terribly confused because I thought I learned the one view, but then eventually I started learning, oh, there's three sub-views to every
mm-hmm.
one view. And I thought, how do I put it together? And unfortunately, I began to believe, I think, that a mature Christian is one who can give a good answer for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just got confused with it all. I had to go back to the basics and really, really just take my time in learning and give myself permission to do that.
Are you saying that part of the problem was you saw so many variations among believing Christians that you kind of felt, well, look, if they can't even figure it out, then how am I going to figure it out? And so then you began to lose confidence in the whole enterprise? Am I catching this right, or is there something else?
Yes, I would feel some of that, but there were so many things that would go on. Like, you know, my mind would think, okay, the church explodes and grows in Acts 2. The New Testament wasn't put together yet.
Mm-hmm.
The church is growing, And then there was a long process by which, you know, how the Bible was put together and what made this reliable and what made this trustworthy. And going back and looking at some of these early historians and how they talked about how it was put together, and in reading church history and seeing how some of these people conflicted with one another,
yeah,
that disturbed me, but it didn't undermine the text. Just what else would you expect in a world with people? We're going to have a lot of views.
Right.
I just struggled getting to the core of it. Well, that can be a hard thing for people.
Well, it sounds like one of your discoveries in the process is just being charitable with yourself. That you don't have to be perfect about everything, and there's a variety of views. And I know when I was first a Christian, I would absolutely go to the mat for eternal security. Man, I would draw blood on that issue. And I think that our security in Christ, perseverance, all of that is really important. But I am so much more committed to the brethren, on these issues that if we're going to get into a discordant conflict of it, I don't want to do that with something as relatively inconsequential as those kinds of things. Deity of Christ, blood atonement, all right, but the issue of truth, fine. But, you know, I've just mellowed out a lot and also changed my views on quite a few things over the years, like you suggested.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I tell my kids, just really enjoy the learning process and don't feel like you have to commit to a position right away. Now, that could sound a little hairy, but here's what I'm saying. I absolutely want to be passionate and committed to mere Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But like you, I think that we're living in a culture that is, Jennifer Hecht, who is an atheist, she talks about this idea of cosmopolitan doubt. And that is when, like, belief A bumps into belief B, and they question whether or not they can trust their belief. And so, you know, we have a melting pot culture with the internet. We have all kinds of soundbite information. Everybody thinks they're an authority. And this has created a massive amount of confusion.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to keep focused on the gospel. The church grew when Peter stood up and said, Jesus Christ died for sinners and rose from the grave.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I want to celebrate the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. And based on who Christ is, God becoming flesh, he's the creator.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll get you to the creator, that gets you the resurrection. And then it gives you charity with other people. And, you know, some people want to be as conservative as they can be about their conservatism. I want to be as liberal as I can be about my conservatism without slipping into heresy.
Uh-huh.
I do not want to be a heretic.
Mm-hmm.
But my goodness, I don't want to alienate people that are
yeah.
part of the body of
that's,
Christ.
That's a great way to put the sentiment that I spent a lot more words expressing just a bit ago. One thing that's an encouragement to me, we'll go to break in just a second here, Bobby Conway, but one of the things that's an encouragement to me from the text on doubt is John the Baptist. How John the Baptist himself, you know, he gets a revelation from the Father about Jesus being the Messiah and hearing the voice of the Father, yet when things didn't quite go the way he expected them to go and he finds himself in prison, he sends a messenger to Jesus and says, are you the one, or should we look for, you know, someone else? And see, even the great John the Baptist, who Jesus said was the best, greatest prophet, you know, even he had his struggles. So it makes me feel, I guess, more charitable towards myself when I struggle, and certainly more charitable towards others when they have doubts and wonderings themselves.
If Adam and Eve could doubt in paradise, how much more are we susceptible to doubting in paradise lost?
Wow, well put. Talking to Bobby Conway here, his book is Doubting Toward Faith, The Journey to Confident Christianity. We'll be back with Bobby Conway and more conversation when we return on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, Access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free, so download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
If you lack the time to wade through thick volumes to get a solid grasp of tough topics, STR has a short and sweet solution. Our Ambassador's Guides are quick reads that give you easily digestible answers to crucial concerns you face as a Christian ambassador. Each volume in this series equips you with the information and outlook you need to understand an issue confronting Christians today. When you visit the STR store at str.org, you'll find a library of Ambassador's Guides, including guides to Mormonism, Islam, Postmodernism, the New Atheists, Pluralism, Understanding Homosexuality, and The Voice of God. To order copies and become a better equipped and more knowledgeable ambassador, visit the online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON. That's 800-273-2766.
Well, the show is done. Well, the show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry about that. And I'm Greg Kokel with my friend Bobby Conway and his book, Doubting Toward Faith, The Journey to Confident Christianity. And I want to encourage you to get this book, friends, because as we were talking about just a little bit ago, there is not anyone who does not doubt who, well, I was going to say who's a Christian, but I guess we could say, Bobby, there is not anyone who does not doubt. That's why you mentioned that doubt is not a Christian problem. It's a human problem, just because, you know, we have a limited ability to know things. And so it's not surprising then, especially when there's so many inducements to doubt in the culture when Christians begin to doubt. I think two things, now that I think about it, and you talk about both of them, the inducements to doubt and what most Christians experience in terms of defense for their faith or rationale for their faith, which is often really, really non-existent. I'm thinking about all the things that are happening now that are just pounding away at Christians, Bobby, that is just and if they don't have any help, if they just got a rank and file kind of Christian life and believe it, God says it, I believe it, God, that settles it, which I understand the sentiment and the conviction about the scriptures, but at the same time, a lot of people, that's all they got, and there's nothing else to answer the challenges coming from everywhere nowadays. That's going to be tough for them, isn't it?
I do think that as a church, we're going to really have to figure out a way to be preemptive in dealing with some of what's going on. I mean, just for example, you've got the new atheists that they're noisy and they certainly are rallying together to, undermine Christianity. So you got that going on from the outside. But then even from within, you have people like Matthew Vines, who wrote the Gay Gospel, and they have their Reformation Project, whereby they're seeking to go from church to church to church to church to equip them how to deal with the six passages, the three in the old, the three in the new, as it relates to homosexuality, to give an answer that would undercut what the church has traditionally been taught there. So all that to say, from the outside and from the inside, you have people who are being very intentional to undermine the Bible altogether or to redefine it. And we have to be proactive in the church and realize, yes, we need to love each other. Yes, we need small groups. All that stuff's wonderful, but we need pastors who keep learning once they get out of seminary, and they learn on a bigger level than pop culture. They pay attention so that they can apologetically equip their churches how to defend the truth, because other people are going to come to seek to undermine them.
You know, this is a little bit of an aside, but it does apply. I'm putting together a thing that I'm just calling the Titus test, and if you look at Titus chapter 1 and you look at what Paul tells Titus to go and get appoint elders, Paul tells Titus, that's right, I got it in the right order, to appoint elders. And he says he wants them to appoint elders that are, I don't want to get the words wrong here, that hold, in addition to the character qualities, that hold fast to the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able to both exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict, because there are many rebellious men, empty talkers, deceivers, who must be silenced. So I'm thinking about this now, Bobby, and you're a pastor. And, you know, in our church, we got elders, and most churches have elders. And I'm wondering how many elders actually do pass this test? How many elders that are supposed to be guarding the flock of the church are capable of defending sound doctrine and silencing those who contradict, who must be silenced because they're upsetting the church? And these are the kinds of things you're just describing that needs to happen. This is the job of elders in the church, which would be the pastor and the ruling elders, the people in authority. How many of those people can actually do the job nowadays? And I don't even mean to be specialists in apologetics. I mean just even doctrinally. It's a little scary to me.
It is, and I think that it makes me think of the scriptures, you know, watch your life and doctrine closely.
Yeah.
And a lot of the teaching that we have, again, from very well-intended people that you and I would consider for sure Christian, you know, brothers out there that love the Lord. And but this whole idea of watching your life and doctrine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have to be able to help the flock to understand the doctrine. And unfortunately, I think a lot, there'd be a lot of elders that wouldn't have a clue who Matthew Vines is, or the new atheist, and what's the difference between a new atheist and atheist. And I know it can get overwhelming, you know, and as well as I know, boy, there's a lot of information, and we can get crushed by it. But
right. But
we should be aware of some of the big trends that are happening in our culture
right
now, and what it means for the gender revolution, and Matthew Vines, and the new atheist, and secularism and pluralism, and how do we equip our church in some of those main areas? So sometimes we're teaching our church apologetics maybe in the West here about how to defend the faith if you get in a conversation with a Buddhist. Well, that's important, and I'm not wanting to undermine that, but unless you live in Hawaii, if you're living in certain places, we need to be very intentional what we're teaching them to know how to defend the faith in their context.
Well, you know, when I look at this passage I just read, though, if elders are not able to do that within their context, whatever is wreaking havoc with the flock, if they can't do that, and right now in America, the Matthew Vines stuff, well, then they don't qualify. They just don't qualify. And that's why I have the Titus test. I won't say any more about it, except for I'm putting together a series of questions. How do you deal with this or this or this or this? How do you deal with the six verses in the Bible that teach against homosexuality? How do you silence Matthew Vines? And if nowadays elder can't silence Matthew Vines, can't give a response for his congregation that's adequate to the task, then they are not living up to the requirements that Titus is in Titus for elders. Separate issue. Okay, we'll move on from that. But we are talking broadly about the same thing, about the church being protected from things that would cause them to doubt. So you write here, Bobby, for Christians, doubt can either serve us or sink us. So how could doubt serve us? And I actually think this question goes to the whole purpose of your book.
Well, it is an interesting thought. I mean, look, there's good doubt and there's bad doubt. And I guess you would say good doubt is doubting all non-truth. But doubts can, number one, it can become the material by which God makes an apologist. Many of the apologists that I know and that you know, they were made in the furnace of their doubt because they have a question and they feel the doubt of it and they pursue the answers. So I could have never wrote the book that I wrote had I not went through that furnace of doubt in my own life. And so it's a good example of how God can turn good out of it. So some of the good things that come out of it can help you to be more humble about your opinions. It can help you to realize, wow, maybe I don't have it all together. It can create dependency. It can develop your study habit.
Mm-hmm.
It can also show you that reading books it takes more than that, because for every question you chase down, you collect another dozen. For every book that you read, you learn about 10 more you need to read. And eventually that snowball gets so big that if we don't have a passionate heart to love Jesus, to seek his heart in prayer, if we just try to do the doubt project solely in our head, reading and analyzing, our heart will die. I think we have to keep our heart growing, and that might mean fasting, Greg. That might mean getting on our face. That might mean worshiping and singing. Mm-hmm. A lot is involved in working our way out of doubt. It creates a great dependent spirit for the individual to trust Christ.
Mm-hmm. Your book's foreword was written by Sean McDowell, and I know that Sean himself, the son of the great Josh McDowell, had his season of doubt where he had to work this out for himself, and that he was given the freedom by his own dad, Josh McDowell, the freedom by his dad to work it out without any illicit pressure, you know, was a huge thing for him. Do you think the church sometimes contributes to the problem of doubt by not offering us the freedom to work through these things, not legitimizing that?
I do. I think I like to say, you know, we need to help people to doubt out loud so we can help them to doubt towards faith. If people are going to doubt, we got a bunch of closet doubters in the church, but what can happen is we can show up in our small groups and we can talk to pastors or other people about our fears and our worries and maybe the guilt of our sins. But for a Christian to say, you know, I was reading my Bible this week and, you know, this whole thing about the sons of God and the daughters of men and you know, Genesis 6, I really just found myself struggling with the Bible. I just can't relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
People don't feel the freedom to talk about that. Now, I don't think we should be celebrating our doubts. Doubts can be very dangerous. They can sink us. But I do think that you're going to doubt anyway, so you might as well doubt out loud around people who can help you.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I think we need to be careful. Like, for me, I don't just need to go sit with someone and share all my doubts because I'm sure they have enough doubt material of their own. But if I was struggling with some doubts, I would talk to you, Greg, and say, Greg, you know, you've been an apologist a lot longer than me, and can you help me to track through this? You wouldn't panic. The problem is I think a lot of people in the church are threatened by doubts, and they panic, so they'll shut it down, and then as a result, people leave the church, and they think that we're just built full of nonsense, and it's just not true. They just had a bad encounter with the wrong person.
Yeah, now, do you have kids? Is that right, Bobby?
I do, 16-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old son.
Okay, give our parents here, recommend to them how they should address this issue. You do talk about it a little bit in the book, the importance of parents in giving their children permission to doubt. What does that look like?
You know, for me, discipleship with my kids, it's not a moment. It truly is an organic lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for parents to stay in conversation with their kids, when they watch movies, when they listen to music, helping them to be aware of the messages that they're getting. For instance, I think it would be a good project. Print off all the music of the top 10 songs your kids have listened to, and then have them read the lyrics and without the music and see what kind of messages are being sent. Help them to be discerning. Ask them what their questions are. Let them know just by simply saying, hey, I just want you to know that if you ever have doubts about the faith, or you ever have struggles, I just want you to know, I might not be able to answer the questions, but this is a culture, our home, where you can, and I will be committed, even if I don't know the answer, to finding somebody that will be willing to help you with that. And so I want my kids to know that, and they know that their father has just written a book on doubt, and they saw me going through seasons of my own struggle. You have to be careful with that. I mean, there's wisdom, but I think that there can be a place where they can hear me say, you know, if they ask me a question, you know, son, that's a good question. I struggle with that too. But let me share with you how I proceed to love God in spite. So I like to say it like this: I love the God I doubt. I hate that I doubt, but I love the God that I doubt. I wish I didn't doubt, but Habakkuk doubted, and Abraham doubted, and Thomas doubted, and Peter doubted,
and John the Baptist.
We see it all over the place,
right? You know, I remember the first time. My 10-year-old now, almost 11, but when she was 8, she said to me, and she's a baptized Christian at the time, and I wouldn't have had her baptized if I wasn't convinced she was born again, you know, so I think it's the real deal. But still, she said to me, she said, Papa, how do we know that God is true, I think is the way she put it. How do we know that God is true? And the very first time she'd ever said anything like that, And I think some parents might have panicked at that point. Wait a minute, you're a Christian. How could you ask whether God is true or not? If he wasn't true, you couldn't be a Christian, or something to that effect. But it didn't trouble me. I was glad that she was raising it. I mean, I've been schooled, obviously, in apologetics, so I'm thinking, okay, this is an opportunity to teach something. And I had an insight at that moment that I would never have had if she hadn't asked it quite that way, because I got to think of, how do I answer this for my 8-year-old? And what I ended up saying was, the reason we believe in God is because he's the best explanation for the way things are. He's the best explanation for the way things are. And I thought to myself, hey, I can take that to the bank with lots of people, not just my 8-year-old. You know, and it ended up serving me. Now, I have repeated that with her. I've kind of revisited that with her because I want her to incorporate that in her own mental life. God is the best explanation for the ways the things are. Of course, you can go in a lot of directions, the moral issue, the cosmological issue, the teleological. You know, you can refine it as time goes on and she's able to understand. But had she not asked the question, I wouldn't have had that opportunity to kind of try to figure out a way to make sense of it to her that ended up serving other purposes as well. So what would you say are the chief questions nowadays, and we're talking about challenges from the outside now, that would maybe plague the minds of our young people to create doubt? Are there particular things that are kind of launched at Christians that shake Christians up and they can't respond to, and because of that they start to doubt?
I think some of the questions that have been heightened in our culture, Greg, would be because of media and the world being so accessible through the internet and living in a diversified culture, being much more eclectic, the exclusivity of Jesus Christ, is Jesus really the only way? Mm-hmm. That can create questions in our culture, certainly, as a result of some of the pluralism. But you also have this secularism flair that in our culture, you know, because of so-called separation of science and faith, as if, you know, we both would know that science, everybody has faith, properly defined, confidence in what they believe to be the right answer based on the evidence. I think that there's many people in the church sometimes that just wonder, God, where are you? So I think in the problem, or in the face of evil and suffering, God, are you really out there? I think that's another one. So notice, though, I think those two questions, is Jesus the only way, you know, God, are you there, and is a result of the secular pluralistic culture. I also would add, I think that there is a tremendous amount of confusion as it relates to gender, and as a result of the transition in our culture with homosexual marriage, and the way values go is they go from once being rejected to then being tolerated, to then being accepted, to then being celebrated, and you reject the very thing, and so it works in complete reverse. So take homosexuality, once rejected in the culture, then tolerated, then accepted, then celebrated. Now you're rejected if you don't agree with it.
Yeah, the
and
next.
So I think that creates, it looks like moral relativism to some.
Yeah, right. Well, you got the fifth word in that sequence is enforced, you know. But I think that's what you were mentioning. That it's not just celebrated, then it becomes enforced, and if you don't go along with it, you get punished. And that's the stage we're moving into now very, very quickly. And look, a lot of young people don't want to get punished from their culture, and they have gay friends, and they think, well, what's the big deal? And so if Christianity seems to require them to hate the friends that they think are fine, then this is going to create that's going to be a train wreck for them. You know, so that's a good list. The exclusivity of Christ, religious pluralism, secularism in general, evil, the problem of evil, and the gender issues in same-sex marriage. I think you're right about those. I think those are things that are just pounding away at our young people. You talk about taking, and your doubts to Jesus. When we come back, I want to talk about that just a little bit. And you've hinted at that already, Bobby, but I want to jump into that when we return from our break. Talking with Bobby Conway here, he is the author of The Fifth Gospel, which we've talked about last year sometime, I think, and you might know him best from the 1-Minute Apologist videos, the 800 of them or so available on YouTube. He's a pastor of Life Fellowship Church. And, you know, it says Charlotte here, but you're not in Charlotte. You're in Lake Norman, right?
Yeah, it's in the Lake Norman area, the first suburbs north of Charlotte.
Yeah, right. And anyway, the book by Bobby Conway, Doubting Toward Faith. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you a student with hard questions about God, Jesus, or the Bible? Or do you have a student in your life who is asking questions that you aren't prepared to answer? Then it's time to pay a visit to the student resources page at strnextgen.com, where you'll find tons of fresh and compelling information for students, parents, and youth leaders. It's a rich collection of articles and videos, including responses to common objections about the Christian faith. And there's even a place where you can invite me, Brett Kunkel, to speak at your local school or church. So head over to the student resources page today. Just visit strnextgen.com.
Would you like to know the one unifying theme of the entire Bible? Greg Kokel reveals it to you in The Bible Fast Forward, his sweeping 8-lesson series on DVD. Greg demonstrates, from Genesis to Revelation, that the Bible represents one cohesive plan of salvation. This fascinating tour of Scripture shows you how the events, covenants, and promises of the Old Testament come to their perfect focus and fulfillment in Jesus Christ. This masterful survey of God's redemptive plan is available to you on DVD or on demand via HD streaming or download. It also includes a comprehensive 145-page study outline with questions for reflection or group discussion. To order the Bible Fast Forward, visit STR's online store at store.str.org or call 800-2-REASON today.
Just to give you an idea, some things coming up for me on the 13th through the 15th of November, I'll be at the Bethel Church at Fairbanks, Alaska. And that's probably going to be a little chilly, but I'm sure it'll be warm inside the church. And on 19th through the 21st of November, I'll be at Cornerstone Church in Ames, Iowa. That's where the University of Iowa is, I think. So I've done some work with them before. I'm really looking forward to that. If you want details, you can go to our website and look at the schedule. You might be able to connect if you're in either Fairbanks, Alaska, which I've never been to before, and I'm looking forward to meeting the folks out there, or Ames, Iowa. So keep that in mind. Also, mark your calendars for our cruise, August 6th through 13th, coming up next year. Next year would be next August. We'll be in Juneau, Sitka, Ketchikan, Victoria, B.C. It's going to be a great cruise. J. Warner Wallace is on board with us from Cold Case Christianity. John Stone Street will be with us in the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. Greg Kokel from Stand to Reason, also one of your instructors. So just think of what it will be like to be able to spend a week with all of us on a fabulous cruise. Okay, we've done this two other times before in Alaska. It's our best cruise. We love it, and we think you will too. So check it out at inspirationcruises.com/STR for all of the information. All right, well, back with Bobby Conway here. He's the author of Doubting Towards Faith, The Journey to Confident Christianity. Bobby, I had mentioned a comment or something you say in the book about you taking your doubts to Jesus. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm referring to the fact that don't just stay up in your head and, you know, just Jesus says he's with us always to the end of the age. Mm-hmm. You see that when he was with his disciples, when Jesus would teach, he'd break away, and then the real curious ones would go up to him and ask him questions. It was just sometimes Jesus purposely taught just a little bit high mm-hmm. to see who would come up to him, and he'd say, to you, the kingdom of heaven has been mm-hmm. given. And, you know, what did you mean by that, Jesus, they would say. They would take their questions, and I think we need to take our questions, we need to take our doubts, we need to realize that these types of issues that we face in life, we just need to get before him in prayer. Mm-hmm. He had it modeled for us, a very intimate relationship with the Father. It says in Mark 1:35, early in the morning while it was still dark, Jesus went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying he went off to pray through his doubts, but I'm saying that he modeled dependency upon the Father. Mm-hmm. And always, whether it's our guilt or if it's our fears or if it's our worries, and even in our doubts. We need to take our issues to Jesus because he can handle them.
Mm-hmm. I've often thought about that passage in Mark where it says, early in the morning, while it was dark, he went off and departed to a lonely place and was praying there. I mean, it continues to emphasize the solitary intimacy of prayer for Jesus. I was instructed by that. I'm glad you mentioned that verse. And I had never thought about this concept until I read it in your book, that when you have doubts, taking it to Jesus, let him know about it. Let him talk with him about it and experience your doubts or field your doubts in the context of that intimate relationship. It's great.
And even what it does, I think, is being authentic with him about it, because we can be very packaged and superficial in our prayers, but imagine going into prayer, and I would be very real and raw. I heard someone once say, we need more Jewish prayers. And what they meant is when you read the Psalms, they were very raw. Why have you forsaken me? Yeah. Where have you went? Why have you abandoned
How
me?
How long, O Lord? Yeah.
Yes. That's so you go with that kind of desperation. I think sometimes we don't do that. And I think, God, you know what? I'm really struggling right now with why this happened and being real. And I think that kind of authenticity can create intimacy. And there's times where I know if I really, really seek God, it's just incredible when you sense his presence. I mean, boy, just one splash of his presence can do a lot more than reading 100 books.
Yeah, and to some degree, I mean, having experienced this kind of thing myself and on other types of issues, going aggressively and honestly before God with frustrations and challenges, there is something that's therapeutic, it seems, like just kind of getting it off our chest there before him. And I don't mean just getting it off our chest, because we can get it off our chest lots of ways, but we're getting it off our chest before him, that is, before the person with whom we have to do and who is able to do something about it. And so it's not just a venting, but it's an appeal to God to act. And so it's so much more deeply satisfying than just, you know, venting, as it were. But you know, you have a couple chapters on what you call doubt triggers, and I thought we'd spend some time here. We only have about 12 more minutes, but to talk about some of these triggers and then close up with the four different facets or four different kinds of doubt, because I think that is a really great insight that you close the book with. So talk about some of your doubt triggers, what they are and how they operate.
So there's a lot of doubt triggers, and what I'm getting at is kind of what triggers doubt for you. And I think if somebody that's struggling with doubts, they could figure out a way to force rank their doubts and then begin to deal with those in order. Our doubts, I believe, is the material whereby God wants to sanctify us. So, like, you know, a lot of times we just don't read intentionally. We need to read in the area of our life difficulties. If you're struggling with fears, read around that. If you're struggling with doubts, read around those doubts. Be wise in that, in the way that we do that. And so some of the different doubt triggers, the list could go on. I just identified several of them. So like, you know, living in a world where I talk about that we can't relate to the Bible. Mm-hmm. So I talk about the apparent ridiculous. So you're reading your Bible sometimes and you come across these stories, you know, falling manna or, you know, parting water or
talking
floating
snakes.
Axe head or Ezekiel laying on his side for 390 days and flipping over and doing another 40 days. Mm. And you see some of this stuff and you think, this is really bizarre. It just seems like almost absurd. I can't even relate to it. You know, Abraham goes sacrifice Isaac. What's going on? And what happens is that we seek to impose a 21st century understanding on an ancient day milieu, we are going to be bound to be upset. Emotionally, intellectually. So we have to really become contextual Christians. We need to understand the context, what's going on in that time. God met people in their own time. I mean, face it, if that ancient culture could see our world today, they would think there's a lot of things that are really ridiculous about us as well. But God met them in that culture, and sometimes that's one of the triggers. And so I talk about, you know, what are those things? The apparent Bible contradictions can cause people to slip into doubt. Stuff like that.
When I think of the apparent ridiculous, think of the talking snake, that comes up a lot. And I think, well, wait a minute, let's dial back a couple more pages. This part where it says, in the beginning, God created in the heavens and the earth. That's like a pretty big deal, right? Ever hear the Big Bang? Well, the Big Bang needs a big banger, you know? And so we have scientific evidence for the first miracle, which is the biggest miracle, arguably, of the Bible. If God could bang the whole universe into existence, getting a snake to talk, no big deal. You know, if you start out with the opening salvo there, and especially since there's good evidence that that's exactly what took place, well, that gives credibility to a whole bunch of other things that at least on the surface appear ridiculous. So,
I think some of the confusion might be, why don't we tend to see as much of this today? But I think one of the things that can be helpful for us to realize is when you take the amount of time whereby the story of the scriptures went on, I think there's something like 250 miracles in the Bible, and if you divvy that up amongst the years of which the Bible story and the narrative is going on, I mean, you got 7 or 8 miracles on average a year. Not that they happen that way, but all that to say, it was even rarer then. That's what made it a miracle.
Right. 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 You mentioned here about internet bloggers, and I think that is a significant source of doubt for a lot of Christians, just the internet in general. But that's unique to our era. Can you talk a bit about that?
I have a concern that many people are being influenced by the blogosphere in an unhealthy way. I think there's plenty of legit bloggers out there. I mean, you mentioned J. Warner Wallace. What a great blogger. I mean, a reliable person who will give good evidence. But there's many people out there that are just self-proclaimed bloggers. They don't cite things. They just kind of, you know, they just write from their emotions. They're not really grounding their stuff in good facts. And then they get a tribe. And the tribe begins to follow them, and they begin to latch on, and we begin multiplying their statements. And I really think that we need to make sure that we look at people citing things, and we make sure that they have credibility. We make sure that that their voice is grounded versus just people who have a bone to pick with the church, and then they go out and they air their observations out, and everybody just falls in line.
Well, I think of the Zeitgeist Recycled Redeemer thing, that Jesus is just a rehashed rising, dying Savior from the myths of old, and how often this comes up. And I remember I was at Purdue a few years ago, and during the Q&A, this came up, and I just made the offhanded comment, because I've heard this so many times, and it's it's not justified at all. This is just an urban legend, this idea of Jesus being the recycled redeemer. And I've heard it. I just said to the audience, I said to the person who asked the question, I said, you've been spending too much time on the internet. And I didn't mean it in an offensive way. It just came out. And everybody started laughing. And so it's almost like they already have this sense that you can find all kinds of nonsense on the internet that sounds persuasive but doesn't have any solid backing to it. And Christians run into this, and then they get upended by it.
Yeah, and I think that's where, as pastors and churches, as a pastor, I'm passionate about other pastors just letting their flocks know, hey, be careful what you're reading, and as parents, being careful as well. I know that John Stone Street, I think he, or Eric Metaxas actually, just came out with an article just this past week at their website, and one of the nice things about it, they have an entire feature up there for some of the different fictional books that are being put out aimed at teens. And what Metaxas was contending, like, only 3% of people struggle with homosexual issues, yet these fiction books that are targeted at teens, it would seem as if so many people do. And so these fiction writers are just writing stuff because they have a bigger agenda, yet the facts are it's really about 3%.
Right.
And so if we'll be aware of these sites we can go to, we can really help even equip our kids and our churches and so on and so forth.
Well, you close the book talking about 4 different facets of doubt, and I recall this material. I remember Gary Habermas, who wrote a glowing endorsement of your book, he talks about this too. Talk about the 4 different facets or different kinds of doubt that we might encounter.
So some of the different facets, and again, I wouldn't want to say there's only four. I'm just trying to give some four observations that I want to share.
Right.
I talk about volitional doubt. And what I mean by that is volitional doubt is this sense of, hey, I sense that God wants me to go to be a missionary, per se, but I really don't want to surrender. And so you end up in a battle of the wills. Does God really know what's best for me? Or I like this girl a whole lot. You hear my emotions tell me I want to continue to go on in a relationship, but I'm wondering if God's telling me to break this thing off. So you get in volitional doubt.
Or maybe she's not a Christian.
Trust God.
Yeah, maybe she's not a Christian. It's pretty straightforward, but you don't want to accept that. Right. Okay, so there's a kind of choosing to doubt because you have self-interests that are inconsistent with the truth.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that can kind of mess volitionally. Then there's emotional doubt. I think this would be the one that's most obvious in our life where we see suffering or something doesn't go our way and we feel a lot of angst in our life. Intellectual doubt, would be things of the nature of all these different questions that we can bring up and we can have. And intellectual doubt, if it sits long enough, it eventually will begin to absorb into our emotions
mm-hmm.
as Christians. So intellectual doubt can become emotional doubt because mm-hmm. if you're really wondering, God, are you there? That's going to bother you emotionally, too,
mm-hmm.
If you're a believer who loves God, obviously. And then evidential doubt's another one. I've got some of my intellectual questions being answered, but is there enough evidence to really close this intellectual doubt gap for
mm-hmm.
me? And so we can wonder about that. What provides the best evidence
to
my doubts?
Intellectual doubt would be the kind of direct challenges to one's views, and even mm-hmm. if you start getting answers to that, you wonder if you have enough information. That's the evidential aspect of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Does Satan have a role in this whole enterprise, Bobby?
Well, I believe it does, and by faith... think of the word confidence. So like when I played baseball, if my coach would say, hey, I got faith in you, Bobby. Well, mm-hmm. he wasn't saying, like, oh, I got faith in you like I've never pitched before and that, he was just putting the ball in my hand. No, he had faith in me based on the way that I pitched in the past that I could get the job done in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we say we have faith in God, what we mean is we have confidence in him that he's the sustainer of the universe based on what we know about him, that he is trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's why we want to lean into him mm-hmm. as our God. And so faith is putting our confidence in the evidence that we do have, and then certainly there is going to be some mystery there too.
Yeah.
I think that's just going to be a part of it, that we aren't going to be able to completely close that doubt gap.
Well,
nobody's going to have it complete.
Well put, Bobby. Bobby Conway here, the book Doubting Toward Faith, The Journey to Confident Christianity, definitely worth having on your shelf to help you because everyone will face this sooner or later. Bobby, I look forward to the next time we can get together.
Thanks so much, Greg. I appreciate you, buddy.
Yeah, it's good having you on board. Once again, Bobby Conway, Doubting Towards Faith, and that's it for us, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for your time and spending an hour with me. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.